continuing the discussion about security to our south, this is a question about drugs. With all that comes from drugs, meaning money, and then all that generates in these countries, how far away is the CIA's policy or interests or desires with respect to drugs in these countries from those stated by the Reagan administration?
Well, the CIA is going to follow administration policy, whoever the administration is. No question about it. Does CIA collect intelligence on drugs? Yes. And turns it over to the Drug Enforcement Agency. This is the major agency that we have working on the drug problem. They get any intelligence that CIA has. CIA has identified, factories up in the Golden Triangle, caravans, things of that nature, turned them over to the appropriate people, and actions have been taken against it. I wish I had a simple answer to the drug problem, but I don't. But I do know that CIA will help to the extent it can on something that is a high national priority program.
Man in red.
Again, one of the problems, your discussion on corporate action with CIA, we can't know what the CIA is doing in the future. We can't really know what it's doing in the present. The only thing taking corporate action seriously is that we know what has been done in the past. One of the problems that I feel is that I really can't develop a trust with an organization that I can't even learn about.
Sure.
What proposals do you have, if any, of building up that trust in a positive direction and building up the accountability to the American public?
That's a very good question, and it's a question that I've wrestled with for a long time. I basically agree with the philosophy that it's the exceptions that are authorized and that we shouldn't sort of willy-nilly do it all over the place. But the fact is that I sort of said, well, is there a way of, you know, putting out enough information about CIA so that it becomes your lovable CIA? The answer is no. The one thing that you can do, and I think it's the only thing that you can do, is to develop the confidence in the president and the executive branch that the CIA is doing what it should do and not what it shouldn't do, and develop the confidence in the committees of the Senate and the House who are responsible for knowing about it and doing it, that it's going to do what it's supposed to do and not what it's not supposed to do. Those people will speak for it. For one thing, they will either give it more appropriation or they won't. But they will also speak for it publicly. The committees of the Congress will put out an occasional public report in which they will make criticisms, but they will also indicate that, in general, they are content with what's going on, depending on how they feel in any case. They obviously took a negative on the Iran-Contra performance. All you can do in relationship with the public at large and its media representatives, and I mean the media representatives, is to urge them into some sense of proportion about the thing. Now, how much involved was CIA in the Iran-Contra? Not very much. The thing essentially, not that it wasn't at all, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that, but not very much. On the Iran side, it came in late because Ollie North couldn't get the missiles delivered, and then it delivered the missiles. The decision-making was in the White House, had practically nothing to do with the money, although at one point I think Ollie North used a bank account or something. I think it used one bank account that the CIA had to move some of the money and got the money out the other end for a change. On the Contra side, three or four, something like that, CIA officers did help Ollie North under the mistaken impression that what he was doing represented White House approval, even though CIA had sent a message out to its people after the Boland Amendment, whatever version, no more help to the Contras. In other words, they violated the internal directive. Now, did they do what was wrong? Yeah, sure. But can you try to get a sense of proportion, that instead of seeing CIA running hog wild all over the place, that these were things that it shouldn't have done, but don't let it totally dominate the screen, as it does sometimes. And that's about all I can do. I you can't make it a lovable CIA, that's for sure.
Red Burke.
I'm more of a pragmatist than I felt on my notes. My comments are...
Would you stand up so the others can hear it?
Sure.
They can't hear.
My comments will be addressed to what the professor said. You mentioned the German government's actions to bring Lenin, the German army's actions to bring Lenin to Russia. In comparison, we can make a comparison to what our covert actions are based upon. Now, it seems like in our constitutional system, a separation of powers, if there's consensus behind the covert action, the ends of the covert action, say in Afghanistan, then therefore there's not going to be any challenge to it, and that's the basis of morality in the Supreme Court. But when there's disagreement within the populace, and since the separate powers have different loyalties and different factions to pay off and to be represented, therefore, when there's disagreement among the populace, then you're going to have the Congress checking the CIA and the executive branch, which reports to. So it's a very pragmatic answer to the need of moralism and ethics in our covert actions. It provides a consensus. If there's a consensus among the American populace, pretty much consensus like in Afghanistan, then you're not going to have too much restrictions on the covert activity. But when there's a problem, when their government is divided because their citizens are divided, then there's now checks and balances because they're separate and they need cooperation to work. And it's a very pragmatic view of ethics, but nonetheless, it's more restrictive than saying, thou shalt not do this. Thou shalt not do this does not mean anything in real life.
Well, we may have learned that. The experience of the Boland Amendment may have proved your last point, unfortunately. I'd like that argument to be convincing, because I'm persuaded that there may be cases when covert action is the better of several bad alternatives. My problem is that it's hard for me to understand how this machinery of consensus can work when the action has to be planned in secret. How can the American people come to a consensus when the American people aren't allowed in to the planning of the policy? Well, answer to that question is, the conventional answer to that question is, well, they don't have to be let in on the details. All they have to do is be sort of behind the general policy. Well, then the question becomes, what's the general policy? How do we identify the general policy that they're supposed to be behind? I think it'd be very hard to state with sufficient precision to be meaningful the general policy behind which the American people have formed a consensus and which authorizes covert intervention in Cambodia, for example. We are in Cambodia supporting people who, under the pressure of political necessity, are the allies of one of the most heinous political movements in the world. I don't think there's any consensus in the American people behind a policy that supports that covert action. And I think the fact that the covert action has been planned, not really entirely covertly, but hasn't sort of gone through the normal machinery of kind of public scrutiny, is one of the reasons why, in fact, we don't have just what I'd expect to arise if the public debate had taken place fully, namely a real disagreement in the American people. Among the American people about the wisdom and the propriety of that policy. So I guess my answer is I think that the very fact that covert action has to be covert is a fact which makes it difficult for the consensus process to be a fully reliable process in guaranteeing that the covert activity reflects the values and the preferences of the American people. You might want to add something to that.
I'd like to take a little issue with that. Cambodia. I think it's obvious that American policy is opposed to Pol Pot and his cohorts. We make that point in the UN and various other places every time we can. It's also clear that American policy requires the withdrawal of Vietnamese and from Cambodia and the opening up of Cambodia to the participation of the other two democratic forces, those of Sihanouk and Son Sann. The fact that it is well rumored that American assistance is going to those two democratic forces and not going to Pol Pot is clearly known. I mean, that's been known around. And you don't get much criticism of respected senators and congressmen who are not part of the intelligence committees have either indicated support of the hopes that Prince Sihanouk and Son Sann will gain power in Cambodia, and certainly have indicated full support of absolutely rejecting any relationship with Pol Pot and his gang. So I think here the general policy is pretty well known and pretty well accepted. Now, I have no idea how much money is being given to the two democratic groups. I don't know, and I don't think anybody else does. And I don't think it matters an awful lot. The intelligence committees know about it. They apparently don't object to it, or that you'd hear noises about it if they did. So it seems to me that this is a covert action which has been given the proper procedural review, the pragmatic review, if you will, and that it fits within overall policy, which is pretty well known. It's no great surprise to anybody that we may be supporting these two. If it came out that we were supporting Pol Pot, then I agree. Then you'd have an uproar, and for good reason, because it would be a contradiction of our public policy.
Man in the gray jacket.
Earlier, Mr. Colby, you stated that the CIA has never participated in the assassination of any leader. Yet I find that difficult to accept, especially when we look at the example of the murder of Diem. It's true that that Diem was not killed by an American or by an American source, but it's also true that Diem's murders were directed by officials in Washington. And in that way, I see that as CIA murder. My second point that I'd like to make, and maybe you can address both of these, is that you don't really take into account the argument that the end justifies the means. But you do believe that the end justifies the means, yet you don't really question the means. Are the means better than the end, or are they worse? If you could address that.
Sure. Well, the Diem case, I worked with President Diem, and I had great admiration for him. I was part of the struggle in the American government in the summer of 1963 as to whether we should continue to support President Diem or whether we should shift American support to the generals. I was one of those who said we should stay with President Diem. We lost the argument, obviously. I have talked to a number of the generals who were involved in the coup who did get the green light from the Americans, which was decided in the White House. And several of these generals have told me that they went into the operation under the understanding that Diem's life would be spared. He was murdered at the direct order of one general, Big Min, Zhuang Wenmin, by his aide when they were picked up in the APCs, the armored personnel carriers, and brought back to the general staff headquarters. I think it was the most serious mistake we made in Vietnam, the biggest. I'm finishing a book on this. It'll be out next year. And I make that point very firmly, that that's one of the major points. Was the United States involved in it? Yeah, but it wasn't murder. The United States was not interested in having him killed. the general who did it was interested. The other generals were not. Certainly there was no incentive to bring about his death, and it, quite to the contrary, Ambassador Lodge at one point tried to get President Ziem, saying, we can get you an airplane to get you out, and try to save any possibility of his being hurt. So that, it does not equate as an assassination by the Americans, by General Vong Van Minh, yes. And there are a few other cases like that around the world, where somebody with whom we may have been in contact did assassinate their head of state or their head of government. But that's different from the Americans deliberately seeking to accomplish the end, as we did with Castro, although he's obviously still alive. Your other point, give me a word. Oh, no, quite the contrary. I thought I was saying that you have to have justice on both the end and the means. That's the effort to define a just end. The self-defense is just giving you a rubric that you can get at it with, and the means, proportionate means, not excessive means. But the rule is you have to be justified on both ends, not just on one or the other.
Can you bring some practicality to that? For example, maybe addressing the shooting of peasants in Nicaragua?
If you get in guerrilla war, revolutionary struggles in various countries, there are a lot of war. People are going to get hurt on all sides. There's no question about it. The question is whether you try to run it on your side with decency and propriety. That's one of the things I was responsible for in Vietnam, was the program of trying to bring about some pacification, peace to the village, the rural areas. And one of the ways we did it was to give arms to the villagers to defend their communities. And they did. I thought we'd lose a lot of the weapons, but they kept them. Now, we also had a program that you've probably heard about called the Phoenix Program, which was designed to identify who the leaders of the secret communist apparatus were, so that they could be captured, so that we could get them to take the amnesty that was offered to them, or sometimes so we can go and get them in a war, because they were the command and control element of the enemy that was conducting the attacks against the marketplaces and the killing the village chiefs and things of that nature. Sure, it's a war. Now, I've been accused of assassinating 20,000 people and so forth. That's hogwash. It's absolutely untrue. Most of the people killed were killed in military actions, but identified afterwards. There's Mr. Nguyen. We had him on our list as the chief of the tax section. He's dead. He didn't get captured. He didn't take the amnesty. He's dead. So he's not there anymore. How are you going to account for it? Ignore it? No, you're going to report him as killed. And that's what we did. And then people say, oh, you assassinated him. Well, we did not. The instructions were to either capture, if you possibly could, or certainly to get him to take the amnesty if you could, for both moral and practical, pragmatic reasons. If they're alive, they bring you information. If they're dead, they don't.
Yes.
Is there not both an ethical and a practical problem in placing at a higher level of value any end above the telling the truth? Once you assert that proposition, don't you create a situation in which from that point forward, no one can ever again have confidence in believing anything that is said or denied? For example, during the period when it was the policy of the government of the United States to take the position that Radio Free Europe was a program supported by private contributions in which the government had no participation, that was a lie. And if an American citizen said to his fellow citizen, that's a lie, that program is being supported covertly by the government of the United States, and it's really propaganda. That citizen would be demeaned by his government in the eyes of his fellow citizen for telling the truth, because the value is placed higher on maintaining the secrecy of the covert operation than on truth-telling. That has no limit. When the Soviets shot down the flight of the Korean airliner 200 miles beyond their border, over their territory, over military base, the American public was heavily propagandized by its government, as contrasted with the position you expressed quite correctly here today, when, although mistakenly, the United States military vessel shot down a civilian airliner because it thought it was a military operation. Those two situations are very parallel. If anything, the Soviet position is more defensible. It was over their territory. But the way the two were treated to the American people were vastly different. Is that not a consequence of the proposition that you're defending here today, that there are other values that take precedence of telling the truth? And does that not destroy the very fundamental basis of the relationship between the democratic and free people and their government? There was a time when the people of this country believed that other governments lied to their people and to the world, but our government did not, so that we could believe confidently what our government said. That is no longer the case, and that is a direct consequence of the development of covert government. Is it not, sir?
It's a very good question, very, very well stated. Let's get rid of the Soviet thing first. There was a distinction between those two incidents, and that is that the Soviet pilot was on the tail of the plane. And, you know, if an American pilot had been on the tail of an unidentified plane coming in over Oregon, I guarantee you he would have been required to make a positive identification that it really is a Soviet spy plane coming in here and not a wandering civilian plane. Now, I guarantee you that's what would happen, no doubt of it. The Soviet got up, he was excited, and they had had the incident, the previous Korean airplane that went in for 2 hours before being found, and there was hell to pay in the Soviet Air Defense Command over that. And so, and this plane was about to leave Soviet airspace and get away, and he just banged it down without a positive identification. I think that is a distinction. The Vincennes thing, he thought he was under attack, I mean, which is a very different attitude. He thought he was under attack. He was wrong, obviously, and it was a terrible thing, but he thought. But that doesn't answer your main question, which is much more interesting. And I think the answer to your question gets back to that old problem about the difference between the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And there is a distinction between the truth and the whole truth, obviously, in many situations. I'm not being a sophist alone. This is true. Many people go through life making sure they never tell a lie, but they don't necessarily tell the whole truth either. And this is common in human society, in personal relations as well as national ones. I'm not saying we never did tell a lie officially. But it really is not a very wise thing to do, I'll clue you. It doesn't work. Somebody's going to disprove it in a hurry. And then you suffer all of what you say. And therefore, any sensible approach is don't get caught telling a lie. Maybe don't bare all your soul and tell everything. Maybe you do have a secret still there. And maybe you hope to accomplish something because of that secret, which is justifiable. Because you hope to accomplish it that way, then keep it, but don't tell a lie. Now, there are times you'll go further than that. You'll go, if you're going to send somebody into to Tehran to prepare for the landings of the Desert One force to come in and rescue our hostages. And he's going to arrive, and he's going to have a foreign passport. And he's not going to give his true name. And he's going to go there and say he's a businessman looking for business for some country. And he's going to live there, and he's going to walk around the city and try to find a truck and find some other thing, so he'll be prepared to help that mission. Does he tell a lie? You're damn right he does. For good reason. Because he's trying to help that mission to get those hostages in the American embassy. And there were a bunch of fellows with great heroism who went into Iran, to Tehran, to do exactly that. Now, do they tell a lie? Yeah. They do it for a good reason? Yeah. So, you know, you can't be quite as absolute as you state. There are situations where you do have to tell less than the whole truth, certainly, and sometimes go even a little further. Now, they should be very rarely done for good reason, and it's kind of tough to justify it. But I don't think anybody will have much trouble with that particular example, and that's a real case. So it just makes this thing a little more complicated than it seems.
But far removed from the question I asked you.
Well,
it's truth-telling to the people of this country.
Well, he wouldn't tell the truth to the American people either. In fact, no, in that situation. In fact, Stanfield Kerner makes a good point on the this question about you will absolutely tell the Congress everything within 48 hours. And he said, look, I sent some people into Iran. I could not stand there and look them in the face and say, I'm going to tell 10 congressmen about your mission. They wouldn't go. And I wouldn't go if I were they. So he says, I cannot be under that kind of a restraint. You need some loophole to enable him not to tell the Congress certain things. Now, look at it afterwards. If it's justifiable, fine. If it was unjustifiable, criticize the daylights out of him. That's the way you control that. You look at it after the event and then criticize it or accept it.
We're on the verge of going to a third hour. I think we should break up formally. I'd like to thank Charles Bythe and Bill Colby, and thank you all.